Hej!
Hej och välkomna till Havspodden! Idag är vi här med Benjamin Jones som är en sjögräsambassadör utan like. Ben kommer från Storbritannien men bor i Stockholm där han doktorerar i marinbiologi på Stockholms universitet. Ben är också medgrundare av, eller till kanske man säger.
Ja.
Ben är medgrundare till Project Seagrass som är en ideell organisation i syfte att bevara sjögräs runt om i världen. Denna intervju får ni njuta av Bens fina brittiska och lida, eller ja, stå ut med vår underbara svengelska.
Yes. So, welcome Ben.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. It's a pleasure to have you here, or to be at your house actually. We're recording this in your beautiful little cabin.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we had a nice dinner. It's like ideal.
Yeah.
Couldn't be better.
You're the best guest.
All right. So,
this is the first one in English.
Yeah, this is the first one in English. And
sorry about that.
No, don't worry about it. The plan is not to have our podcast in English, but we will have guests from time to time.
Yeah.
So hopefully our listeners can withstand our bad English and your perfectly perfect English.
I'm pretty sure that your English is better than mine.
No, I wouldn't say so. All right, so tell us about yourself. Who is Benjamin Jones?
Oh, well, that's a hard question. That's a very... I'm a marine biologist that studied on the coasts of Wales in the UK. So I grew up pretty much on the beach, spent most of my summers rock pooling and stuff, and I've always been very engaged with the ocean ever since I was a kid. I remember always wanting to be a marine biologist. So yeah, I've kind of, everything I've done up until now has been very ocean related.
Yeah,
that's so cool.
So I feel like I've been a little bit obsessed with the ocean. So that's where I, you know, that's how I became who I am now, I suppose.
Yeah. It happens easily. I recognize myself in that. At least when I started diving.
Yeah.
I was very like, everything was about the ocean and diving. So it really gets to you.
Mm.
That's,
I remember, cool. I remember my first scuba diving experience at age 7 in a swimming pool.
Oh, wow.
This charity sponsored dive, and then did it again, and then a year after, and then as soon as I was 11, and I think the rules have now changed, but I could learn to dive, and then I did passed my open water at age 12. So
that's
since
cool.
Then it's been thousands of dives later.
But you also do like free diving as well.
I think especially since studying seagrass, I've done less diving now because I don't really need to. And the thing I'm interested in is in shallow water. So I can spend even longer there if I don't have a cylinder on. Yeah.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, there's so much you can see just out swimming with a mask.
When
people don't think about it.
No.
So seagrass is the thing that you do now.
So why seagrass of all the fantastic, amazing things in the ocean?
Well, it relates to my undergraduate. I think 2011, I was obsessed with coral reefs. I just bought this cool underwater camera mask that was terrible.
Oh,
really? Masks with a camera in them. But I was super happy, and I was going on holiday to the Dominican Republic, and I rented every coral reef fish ID book I could find in the Swansea University Library. And then I got there and there was this huge mass of, it was seagrass, but I didn't know what it was when I was there. Despite studying marine biology for three years, I had no idea what this thing was. And I spent 2 weeks every day snorkeling in that seagrass meadow. I was like, this is the best thing since sliced bread. It was incredible. I was just so impressed with all the fish and all these different rays and eels. And then I came back and one of my lecturers did a course in tropical marine ecology, and most of it was about seagrass. And then that was it. I was like, this is it. This is my passion. I love this stuff. And then, yeah, that was 7, 8 years ago. So it's been cool. Seagrass since then.
Wow.
This is so cool. This is
really dedicated.
Yeah.
Dedicated or obsessed?
Obsessed.
It's a fine line.
Yeah, it's a fine line. But it's so cool that you kind of found it yourself.
Yeah.
Sometimes you can hear, or you can get a feeling like, oh, don't forget the seagrass. Like, everyone loves coral reefs, but don't forget the seagrass. It's also important. But in your case, you kind of found it yourself and discovered it in a way.
Yeah.
That it is important. It's awesome.
Well, it was
exciting.
Yeah. And I suppose the reason why I started this organization is because I want people to see that and feel the same, wow, kind of factor that kind of got me interested in it. So then, it's pretty cool to, I feel like I could be less obsessed, but it's still good.
Yeah, we will talk much more about your organization, Project Seagrass. But first, you're from England. How did you end up in Sweden?
Well, it's like, I.
Is there even seagrass here?
I'm stuck in Stockholm and I still haven't visited the West Coast where there's lots more seagrass than there is here. But no, I came here I was lucky enough to get a PhD position studying seagrass meadows and their associated fisheries across the Indo-Pacific Ocean, which was kind of what I spent the previous three years doing on a different project that was kind of a similar scope. So I was pretty happy to get the PhD position to come here, come to Stockholm University and carry on my obsession with seagrass.
Yeah, that sounds ideal.
So the research is about seagrass and fisheries.
Yeah. So I think I started off with doing a lot of seagrass ecology work. My master's was about how nutrients affect seagrass meadows across the UK.
Okay.
But I started to get a bit more interested in the ecosystem services side of seagrass and especially mainly fisheries and food security and poverty agendas and stuff that's associated to the sustainable development goals. And so a lot of my work now has kind of gone down this avenue where we look at it from a kind of a more holistic view of how seagrasses support people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which is very important.
It's not a direct, like, you cannot go harvest seagrass and eat it.
No. But some people do in certain areas of the world. But this is one of the like really interesting things about this studying people and seagrass. You uncover all these crazy cool dynamics.
Yeah.
That there's a tribe in northern Mexico on the Sea of Cortez or the Gulf of California, and they consume the seagrass seeds as a type of porridge.
Oh, wow.
And they use the seagrass leaves to smoke deer meat at certain times of year. And actually, the month of April, I think it is, or the month of May, in their language, directly translates to the month when the sea flowers, because it's the month when the seagrass shoots produce all their seeds and stuff. So there are these really cool interactions you find and you pick up in the literature here and there about how people use and kind of have cultural ties to seagrass.
Yeah. That's really interesting.
I'd love to visit this tribe. I need to brush up on my Spanish, I think.
It's manageable.
Yeah.
I think I like in some of your articles that I read a bit from, it was something, other fun fact about seagrass, wasn't it something with weddings or how people use seagrass?
No, maybe that's the mosquito net. As a wedding dress.
Yeah, it was not seagrass, it was mosquito nets. Because you've done quite a lot of work with that as well.
Well, like just one element of work. But I mean, again, from a seagrass perspective and how people use seagrass or use free mosquito nets that they've been given to fish in seagrass. Mm-hmm. And yeah, well, that fun fact was that mosquito nets that have been handed out to prevent malaria have been used to make wedding dresses and and to be used as fishing nets, which is obviously very bad for seagrass.
Yeah, and why is it bad for seagrass?
Well, seagrass meadows are super important for baby fish. So lots of juvenile fish live in seagrass meadows across the world. Wherever there are seagrass meadows, you pretty much have juvenile fish that live there. In the Baltic, we have cod, but in the tropics, there's lots more. There's baby groupers, snappers, all the big classic reef fishes. A lot of them spend a lot of time in seagrasses as kids. So, when you go fishing in a seagrass meadow, effectively you're catching lots of baby fish that eventually go on to populate coral reefs.
Yeah.
And you have no repopulation.
No. And that's one of the big problems with unsustainable seagrass fishing, effectively,
Sounds pretty much like dynamite fishing on coral reefs.
That Oscar talked about.
Yeah. It's really similar. So you're destroying the habitat that is feeding the whole system.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So, if you relate it to people, how do people use the seagrass meadows? Also, why? why is it important to do these kinds of studies?
Well, like, I mean, the poster child for marine conservation is always, you know, coral reefs.
Yeah.
Especially tropical marine conservation. We have to protect the coral reefs for people's livelihoods and for the biodiversity that live there. But we kind of neglect these other habitats that also where a lot of people spend a lot of time, especially those that are really poor in society. The great thing about a seagrass meadow is that you can, at low tide when it's exposed, you could go out there, walk out there without no knowledge as a fisherman. As a kid can go out to a seagrass meadow and pick up a crab, pick up a sea cucumber, pick up a big shell or any other invertebrate and take it home and eat that. It provides a safety net, kind of last resort for anyone that needs a real kind of meal. They can just walk out into a seagrass meadow and pick up something to eat. And that's the thing that I suppose people don't really realise, that all these things are going on. And we call it gleaning, so that's what where you go and collect fish and mainly invertebrates from seagrass meadows at low tide. And it's this undocumented, effectively, fishery. Very few people study it. I think I could count the number of people that study seagrass fisheries in general on in my two hands.
Yeah. Well, I suppose it's very extensive. If you look all over the world, like the fishery... In seagrass meadows.
I think wherever there's a seagrass meadow, there is probably someone fishing
it. Whether it's especially in
low income countries, a big kind of drive there, but also in really well developed countries. I know places in Wales where a father and son might go and collect shrimp using a hand net. And they've been doing that, like his father took him out, and it becomes a recreational or a cultural thing. And I'm sure there's places here in Sweden where, people, anglers go out to catch certain fish and they know that, seagrass is a really good place to do this. So
yeah,
I'm going to go there.
The only problem is that I don't know it's seagrass.
No.
I suppose.
Speaking of that, you're a real ambassador for the seagrass.
Yeah. I mean, everywhere I go, I try to talk about seagrass. Even if I'm in a taxi on the way back from a hotel to get a flight, I was in Mauritius, and I was on my way to the airport, and I was talking to the taxi driver about seagrass, and he's like, we always go out every year, me and my family and stuff, and we go out and collect these things in that area. Because it's what we used to do, and like, you have this tie to seagrass, a cultural family thing to do, and you pick up on all these kind of things that nobody really talks about, that like, you know, there's all these cultural and very family-orientated activities that people might do that are associated to seagrass, which is
that's really cool.
And yeah. You don't get that if you don't talk about it.
No?
Yeah, no. I think let's just take a quick fact around here. What is seagrass? Because I don't think we covered that.
No. So seagrass is a plant that lives in the sea, effectively. It's a flowering plant. It's a true angiosperm. It evolved 200 million years ago, roughly. Is it 200 million years ago?
Long time ago, anyways.
Well, maybe around 100 million. I can't remember the fact, the date exactly.
That's
but
right,
it,
but...
Yeah, yeah. It evolved to live a life underwater from the land. And since then, it's evolved on 4 different occasions to literally spend all of its life underwater. So it even has waterproof pollen, this special kind of waterproof pollen that, you know, it's just like a normal plant you see in your garden. It produces, there's male and female versions of some of the plants. It produces seeds, it produces flowers. Some species even produce fruits that you can eat.
Didn't know that.
Yeah.
Cool.
And Hallas.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Interesting.
It's maybe you've seen one of those spirally.
No,
things.
I haven't really seen that much of Inhalus.
Okay.
No,
I suppose not. Yeah.
No, it's really nerdy now.
Okay,
yeah,
sorry. Yeah, but basically the difference between the seaweeds, it would be really easy, is that the normal plants that you have on land went back to the ocean. Instead of seaweed that was kind of there all the time.
Yeah. So like the main difference between seagrass and seaweed is their rooted nature, I think. Seaweeds attach to rocks using a suction cup, a holdfast, whereas seagrasses always have roots, rhizomes, and exist on soft sedimentary bottoms.
Yeah.
There are very rare occasions where they grow in between rocks and things like that, but they grow on mud and sand.
Yeah.
And most seaweeds tend to grow on a hard surface.
Mm.
Yeah.
And then there's all sorts of...
don't have flowers. And yeah, it's like...
Yeah, the structural differences in how the body of the plant or the seaweed...
Physiological
differences is huge if you look at it really closely.
So not the same thing.
No, definitely not the same thing.
Yes. So
and also another thing, seagrass is not the same seagrass that IKEA sell when you buy a basket or a chair that's seagrass chair. It's one thing that drives me nuts. That grinds my gears.
And also if you buy a seagrass salad at a sushi restaurant.
Yeah.
No, definitely not seagrass.
It's not
obvious. Seagrass.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's seaweed. It's not seagrass.
Yeah.
So we covered that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, now that we know what seagrass is and how important it is for so many people in different areas of the world. Tell us about Project Seagrass.
Well, yeah, I suppose Project Seagrass was born of this idea to educate everyone about why seagrass is so freaking cool. The idea that I had started when I was on a train coming back from sampling seagrass, and I had my rucksack with my seagrass sampling gear or hanging around my neck, and everyone kept asking me, what on earth have you got around your neck?
Where was it?
This was in the UK.
Yeah.
Getting a train from south of England back to Wales. And it drove me nuts. I was so annoyed that nobody knew what seagrasses were. And then it kind of dawned on me that, well, I mean, actually, yeah, I didn't know what they were. And if you go back at all the BBC Natural History Unit documentaries, all of the Blue Planet, the first Blue Planet, and all the other ones that David Attenborough's done, seagrass has never been mentioned. Never mentioned in any natural history documentary until very recently.
Yeah.
And that, I was just like, right, well, how can I do something about this? So overnight, I decided to make this website. I called it Project Seagrass, and started tweeting some cool facts about seagrass. And sharing fun facts on Facebook, and then it kind of all spiraled out of control, and I got in some my colleagues, the guy that taught me about seagrass in the first place, the one that course that I took on tropical marine ecology, and then we've kind of built Project Seagrass up from that to become this global voice for seagrass.
It's almost a movement, I would say.
Yeah, I would call it, it's growing to be a movement now that we have ambassadors in different areas of the world. It's funny that, you know, you go somewhere, wherever, I was in Indonesia diving and I met someone and they knew what Project Seagrass was. Like,
that's really cool.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
That's wow.
That must have felt really
expensive. Yeah, you feel like you're kind of I don't know. You reached out.
Yeah. You inspired people. Yeah. That's so cool.
Yeah. Wow. And it's still small, relatively. It's not big by any standards. We have a fairly decent size following on social media, but that's mainly where our work has been done. Yeah, it's all on kind of trying to raise awareness on the internet effectively. But you can do a lot, and then, you know, from that we've done lots of different documentaries with people. We're always consulted by the BBC, for example, to ask where we should go to film seagrasses, and for Blue Planet 2 we assisted.
Nice.
With the seagrass stuff for that.
Wow.
So it's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Very cool when you get asked by such important actors like BBC and Blue Planet. But you still say that you're a small organization. What is your goal?
Oh, that's a hard. Well, our vision is for a world where seagrass meadows are conserved and managed and given their respect and
recognized,
the appreciation that other habitats get of equal standing. But also, you know, mainly where we can be proud of our seagrass. And I don't know of a single country where they're doing work to really pioneering work to conserving seagrass meadows. There are some really good countries that have done a lot of work and are really kind of championing seagrass meadows. But I wouldn't say that there's any country that we can look at that's the gold standard of seagrass conservation. Yeah. But you've got the gold standard of coral reef protection or rainforest protection or any other kind of things. There's always these gold standards that people look to and think, wow, look at Palau, for example, that have made their whole, pretty much everything, a marine protected area.
Mm.
Although not quite a marine protected area, but still they're really kind of championing coral reefs.
Yeah.
But there's no one that's doing that for seagrass yet. And that's what I'd like to see.
Yeah, that's cool. That's a nice vision.
Mm. Well, I think it's coming.
It's coming, I think.
Yeah. Have you heard about the EU project in Baltic Sea, the restoration of the seagrass?
No,
there is a huge that's restoration.
Been done. Yeah, it's a huge restoration that's been done one month ago. So
yeah, along Skåne's coast. So they basically replanted seagrass. So they took plants, seedlings from a place where there is seagrass.
They transplanted it.
Anyways, you can listen to it in our last episode. We talked a bit about it.
There's links
there to the website, and you have all the information there. But it was a huge
project.
Yeah. And now they're doing the same thing on the west coast.
Mm-hmm.
It's basically it has its roots in a project that is supposed to protect the coastal areas from erosion. So that's the main objective, and the seagrass meadows are really good at finding sediments. So
they're a really good way to stabilize our coasts. They're natural coast and storm defense.
Exactly. So the main reason to do that work on the east coast and in Sweden is not to restore seagrass, although it's a nice side effect of what they are trying to do. And accomplish.
And that's I think we're with Project Seagrass at the moment, where we've got similar project
yeah.
in Wales where we're planting 2 hectares of seagrass.
Mm.
And we've planted nearly 1 million seagrass seeds from seed. So we're not just collecting a plant from somewhere else.
Yeah.
Because
generally.
We that found have its problems. Yeah, yeah. That also has its problems. That we've done some research and that's the most successful way for us to do it by planting the seeds. So we're effectively underwater gardening.
Mm.
But we label that as this you know, 3 kind of benefits. You get your benefit of your coastal protection, your benefit of your carbon sequestration,
yeah.
but also your fisheries too. So it's
yeah.
you know, a win-win for everything.
Mm.
I think labeling that you have all of these different benefits of seagrass restoration that makes it a kind of really easy restoration and reforestation,
yeah.
rewilding kind of project.
Yeah.
But does it work then? Because I remember from my studies, since I also studied seagrass for my master's, that like the success rate from such restoration project was not very high, and it depended a lot on the specific site. So you have to know your place and
yeah,
your seagrass.
Yeah, and I think that's the main thing. We know where we're planting seagrass. We know that there was seagrass there.
Yeah.
The nutrient levels, which were historically really high, which is probably the reason why seagrass was lost, they've been managed pretty well. So
mm.
it's heading in the right direction. And we've planted these seeds in these kind of bags.
Yeah, I saw it on your webpage.
Yeah.
Mm.
And they've worked at other sites. So I mean, we've seen them now. It's a year later since they were planted, and they're starting to poke through.
Mm.
Oh,
so,
that's awesome!
You see these like little baby shoots coming
so cute.
Through. So I think it's you know, with anything there will be some failures,
mm.
but for the most part we see success. But yeah, I think it does depend on location.
Yeah.
You can't. There's no blanket. There's no one method fits all.
Mm.
Yeah. And in Sweden, a lot of the restoration work has been done through transplantation.
Yeah.
But that's quite difficult because you need a very healthy meadow
yeah.
to
mm.
start with. And in the UK, we don't really have that
mm.
many healthy seagrass meadows. Well, they're okay, but they're not like pristine.
No.
And it's quite difficult to then obviously get permission to cut up and chop down
yeah.
somewhere
yeah.
in a really pristine, nice seagrass
yeah.
meadow.
Yeah, it makes sense.
Yeah.
And also to get the seedlings to stick. Here on the East Coast, they used like grids of, what do you call it? Reinforcement steel bars.
Yeah.
So they tie down the seedlings to it
oh,
and
yeah.
put the bars down. And then they will come back like a year later or so. To
okay.
remove the steel bars
mm-hmm.
when they have rooted.
Cool.
Yeah, some really cool projects where they've used these like ceramic, biodegradable ceramic rings.
Wow.
That you tie the shoots
smart.
Onto,
mm.
and then you can just throw them all in.
And they sink.
They sink.
Yeah.
And the ceramic, it's natural as it is. So
yeah,
it's
yeah.
Yeah.
That's very smart.
I did look. We did look up to try find. These things, I just didn't know where to get them, but
yeah.
I thought that was a really cool idea.
Call
just,
me next time,
yeah.
I know where to get them. What is Project Seagrass today? Like, you have this ambassador thing,
and you have restoration projects.
I would say, I would think of Project Seagrass as a very small WWF or. You know, but with a primary focus of seagrass, it's we're a group of scientists that work towards use the science we do to inform policy, to inform action schemes, restoration schemes. But at the same time, we're also as you said, it's a bit of a movement. It's more of a we want to inspire people to get involved with seagrass conservation. And one way people can do that is helping us. Know where find seagrass effectively. So one of the big problems that we face as seagrass scientists is that seagrass meadows are uncharted
yeah.
in most countries. You know, there's still no figure that we could go to
mm.
now online and look. Oh, this is how much seagrass there is in Sweden. We simply don't know. And the same, I don't think there's any country in the world that really knows how much seagrass they have. So one of the measures that we started was this pioneering. Citizen science program, which citizen science is effectively a science based activity that any member of the public can do. You don't need to be a scientist to do it, but you can be a scientist. Anyone can do it.
Yeah.
It's like Artdatabanken.
Yeah, it's the same kind of...
And we started this project called Seagrass Spotter, which is a mobile app and website interface where anyone can go take pictures of seagrass using their mobile phone. If it's intertidal or if you take photos underwater, you can upload them onto the website. We've got an ID guide where people can learn about which species are which, and you can help us map seagrass meadows using photos effectively.
That's really nice.
That's really awesome, and I love your ID guide. It's great. It's so easy to follow, even for a person in the seagrass spotter, even for a person who does
not know
anything about the seagrass.
Yeah, because we wanted it to be really visible, with that's why we used everything was shape based, and I think it's cool because Sweden, I think, on our kind of admin and statistics, I think there's. Sweden is currently third country where we've got the most sightings, I think.
Wow.
Yeah. And there's someone down in Skåne who's been like rock star.
He's awesome.
Uploaded hundreds of
shout out to that person.
Yeah.
He or she is listening.
Reach out to us and we will do a...
he is a marine biologist. He is a marine biologist. I just need to remember his name now.
But it would be really cool to do like a thing.
Like a thing.
Oh, I've completely lost the word for it. Like an event.
Yeah, we'll be talking about it.
Yeah.
But it would be that the perk for us in the UK has been always been that you can actually go and see a seagrass meadow by just walking.
Yeah.
And I think that's the difficult thing here in Sweden that I've even like personally struggled with. I can't just go snorkel and see a seagrass meadow and I've tried and tried and finding them. Like everywhere I look, then I'm like, oh, this should be a seagrass meadow here.
Yeah.
But it's not because the Baltic is so unique.
Yeah.
And seagrass species here coexist with, I think, 17 other different freshwater plant species.
Yeah.
So it's like, there's all of these other things that kind of really, I find that kind of weird. But yeah, I mean... Not weird, but you know, it's very interesting. So it's difficult. You can't just go and walk down to the beach and find some seagrass.
Mm.
So that's one of the challenges I foresee in Sweden with trying to really drum up interest for seagrass.
Yeah.
But I think it's probably a lot
and
easier
also
on the
about,
West Coast.
Like in West Coast, yeah. But then you still have the part about the tides that you don't have such strong tides. So you have to snorkel or go diving for the seagrass. But at least you have large... seagrass meadows there. So
yes,
it's better.
Mm. And also here on the east coast, what I find is that where there is seagrass, usually there is a arranged place to go swimming or like sunbathing
because
they like sand.
Yep.
There is I have never seen seagrass grow in real mud like there is a lot in the Baltic. So where there is sand, there is usually seagrass, and where there is sand, there is people bathing.
Yeah.
So they are walking. So they are walking into the water, and where they are not reaching down to the bottom anymore, there the seagrass starts to grow.
Uh-huh.
So basically from 1.5 to 2 meters, you can find seagrass, and down to 5 or 6, and then it's too dark.
Yeah.
So it's pretty deep. Even if you go snorkeling, maybe you can barely see the seagrass.
Yeah, because the visibility is not that.
Yeah, and also because it starts at such a depth.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's the... The difficulty is, unless you're a diver or a really keen freediver snorkeler, then it's difficult for you to see how awesome seagrass is. But, I mean, everyone goes on holiday to Greece and Thailand there's seagrass all over the place
there. Posidonia in Mediterranean Sea is just...
Mesmerizing.
Yeah.
Well, like, I mean...
It's like trees.
The name for Posidonia... Poseidon's grass.
Yeah.
It's pretty fitting to call the seagrass the god, after the god of the ocean, effectively.
Yeah,
because
yeah.
I think it is the. I mean, in my eyes, it's the king of all seagrasses.
Yeah,
it's so.
It's crazy.
So just
majestic.
Yeah. It's not my favorite species, but it's one of my every time I go to the Med, and I love
it. It's like what do you call
hypnotizing.
It?
Hypnotizing.
Yeah, hypnotizing. Yeah, if you go like snorkeling or diving in it, and it, there's slight wave action.
It deflects.
It's just, you can get so lost in the Posidonia meadow.
And fun fact,
awesome. Yeah.
There's a seagrass Posidonia meadow in Ibiza that's possibly 200,000 years old.
Wow.
No
a
way.
Single clone. That is 200,000 years old.
That's crazy.
That's sick.
I think it's one of the oldest living clones on Earth.
Wow. Wow.
Imagine the things that meadow has seen.
Yeah, you know, when people say that about trees, I'm like, imagine the things that meadow has seen. Yeah. And then like this, I mean, because they're so old in the Mediterranean, they're actually really good at preserving archaeological sites.
Yeah.
So there's a really cool paper and piece of research that they found all these crazy archaeological sites underneath seagrass meadows. So maybe somewhere Atlantis could be existing under a seagrass meadow.
I know it firsthand. Where I used to work on Sardinia, there was a large Posidonia meadow outside. And after each storm, usually there comes up wreck parts from an old Roman ship.
Wow.
And also amphoras.
Wow.
That is buried underneath the seagrass roots.
Wow.
So, yeah. And it's
crazy.
Just outside in the bay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because these, the kind of rhizome, the seagrass root kind of mats that they make, especially Posidonia, they can be like 1.5 meters deep.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Yeah, I remember digging out the seagrass roots in Zanzibar. That was not easy, I can say.
And that's nothing compared
that's
to
Posidonia. Yeah, there's nothing compared. Yeah, it's tiny species in comparison.
Yeah. So, have you seen any impact with your work on seagrass, with Project Seagrass?
I mean, I think it could be, you know, very humble about it. I wouldn't say that everything that Project Seagrass has done has resulted in this big shift.
No.
You know, it's been a collective effort with, you know, the big art between the whole seagrass science community.
Mm.
But there has been a notable increase in awareness, I would say, for seagrass meadows. It's slowly becoming a household name, I think.
Mm-hmm.
In especially in the UK. There's just the other day there was a thing on one of the very, you know, the very popular BBC programmes, and my grandparents are like, oh, we saw seagrass on this show. And it's like it's becoming more of a thing that people understand now and really kind of know about. And we do get lots of emails all the time now, like asking people about concerned about certain things about seagrass, and especially sailors. A lot of sailors email us and like, I'm really concerned about anchoring in seagrass meadows, but I can't find any maps and things to show where we should be anchoring. So there are, you know,
maps are so important in this.
Yeah,
that's also what I wanted to say. That's, I think, a big impact as well, or the thing that we've done is the seagrass spotter, because I don't know any other like platform similar to this where you can find so much geographical information on where you can find the seagrass.
Yeah. Well, that's the whole kind of perk about the website, is you can go in there, you can see this map of the world where there's photos of seagrass. You can you can even, if you're going on holiday somewhere, you can check this map and think, oh, actually there's a seagrass meadow here, somebody's already taken photos of it, I'm gonna go visit it and upload some more photos. And I mean, everywhere I go I look for seagrass just because that's who I am. But I'd love if everyone else could do the same.
And it's also very easy to do this quickly, but then if to upload a sighting, and then if you want to, there is a lot of like extra questions that you can answer.
You can do is take a photo and add. That's the like the basic stuff, but there's also a lot more information if you if you really want to get into it and start identifying fish. If you're really keen, you can. There's lots of stuff you can help us with on the app.
So you can start off by making a sighting. Like, it will take you 2 minutes, and
then you can come back to that site again if you want.
Yeah.
And fill in more about it.
Yeah.
That's nice, because that's also a thing that I like to do when I find an interesting spot underneath the ocean or in the lake. Is to come back to it in different time of the year, because it's really changing a lot.
And that is one of the questions we ask. Have you seen any changes to the seagrass over time?
Mm.
So it gives us this idea of whether or not it's
good
or bad, or
how it's doing.
Have you used the information from seagrass plotter in any?
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, quite regularly we get emails from government agencies or consultancies that want to download the data that's in seagrass plotter, and it's all free. That's the perk of it. If we want it, it's our gift.
Yeah.
Gift
to
the world.
That's so awesome.
Download this. You know how much seagrass you have it's not a seagrass map, but it's a seagrass location database, effectively.
Mm-hmm.
We have consultancies and government agencies just logging in and downloading to add to their inventories. So being used the way we want. And some people have used it for carbon modelling, for looking at blue carbon.
Yeah.
Hmm.
And trying to model how much potential blue carbon there are in coastlines.
Because seagrass is a good carbon sink.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. One of the best.
One of the best.
Yeah.
Compared to like Amazonas, how?
Yeah, well, there's these figures that are thrown around that seagrass meadows are 35 times more effective than the same area of tropical rainforest.
Wow.
And that's Posidonia. Posidonia is the king of carbon.
It depends on the species.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I mean, all seagrasses absorb carbon.
Yeah.
And if we lose seagrass, we also lose that carbon. And there's some pretty disastrous figures that came out of the heat wave in Australia a few years ago in Shark Bay, which is the largest seagrass meadow in the world. More species there exist than anywhere else. But the heat wave caused a huge seagrass die-off.
No.
And the amount of carbon that was released from that dead seagrass was similar to the whole emissions of Australia for that year.
Wow.
Oh my God.
So that's why it's really important that we don't lose
seagrass.
Yeah.
Because it's not just a small kind of, it's a carbon bomb, effectively. Because they absorbed carbon for so long, could be up to 2,000 years worth of carbon locked away in that sandy sediment. So
great.
Yeah.
We want to keep it there.
Yes.
Yeah.
Keep it in the ground.
Yeah, and then we wondered a bit more like practical. So you have your idea and your vision, and it's really easy to understand since you're so crazy about it.
Yeah.
But like on the practical side, how do you start a non-profit organization?
I think
you started with a website.
I mean, there's it depends on whether you want to be a formal or a informal organization. But I mean, anybody that's passionate about anything can start a website, start a Facebook page these days, start a Twitter account, Instagram, and effectively just start talking about something they're interested in, like this podcast.
For example,
it's so easy to become a voice or become a platform where you kind of share your passions.
Yeah.
There's obviously a lot more legal steps and things that are required to start accepting money from big organizations and things like that. But the kind of philosophy of just talking and sharing something that's interesting to you is the same for it can be anything. It can be for cars, for camper vans, for anything.
Yeah, it's really like when we're starting the podcast, it was okay, where do we publish? And there was like, I don't know how many options how to publish, and it was really easy to do.
Yeah.
So it's just out there. So if you are very passionate about something, just do it.
Yeah,
that's my advice. Don't try. For me, I mean, starting with Project Seagrass, it just became like a natural move. I was like, well, what can I get? What have I got to lose? I spent a lot of time doing this stuff, but it's what I enjoy. And I'm happy to do that. So I think, I mean, my advice to anyone that's really interested in starting an NGO, start simple and then
build up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What was the hardest part about? What was the pain in the ass?
Well, the the continuing pain in the ass is funding, I think.
Oh.
Yeah. We have some very dedicated supporters and members that, you know, donate to us on a monthly basis and really kind of give us some really good, you know, donations that we can help keep the organisation running. But to really get these projects off the ground and things like that, we need larger sums of money. And we were discussing this the other day. One of the weirdest things about kind of funding agencies is that they don't like giving large sums of money to small organisations. But to become a large organisation, to accept these big money, you also need these big money coming in. So it's like, how do you get from being a small organisation to a larger organisation if no one gives you any money to become a bigger organisation? That's the current pain in the ass.
But once that gets going, I think, yeah, it will be a new kind of snowball effect.
Yeah. But also, I think the most, like, one of the most important things is partnerships. Like, you can't do anything on your own.
And no.
Working with bigger organisations, smaller organisations, large government bodies and all sorts, you know, you really get things done. And being part of the UNEP, United Nations Environment Programme, Dugong and Conservation and Seagrass Conservation Programme, that was really kind of good for us because it helped us work with a lot of partners all over the world to deliver a toolkit and a project product to help conserve seagrass meadows. Recently, some of us have been authors on a UN global seagrass report that effectively is a nice, easy to read seagrass bible. Effectively, like, this is how important seagrass meadows are, and this is why we need to conserve them, aimed at government agencies. And that's been put together by a huge team of seagrass scientists and, yeah, really good partnerships to kind of create this final product. Yeah,
cool.
So,
that's
great.
Good. Yeah. What's the best part of it?
Everything is great.
everything except great. For the funding.
Well, even that's fun because, you know, you know everything has its ups and downs.
Yeah.
And like when you're successful, you know, I remember spending, you know, a week writing letters just to all sorts of different foundations and trusts. And I write a letter, hello, and, you know, this is Project Seagrass, this is what we're about. Be grateful if you could help us. And you just post these letters off, and then 6 months down the line, you get a check, an old school check in the post.
Oh, like, wow.
Yeah, and you're like, oh, good that someone's read that letter and felt like, and one of them was the Tony Blair Foundation, and you know, one of our previous prime ministers, and his foundation. Yeah, and it's like, yeah, cool. It's interesting that these things happen. So there's always ups and downs to everything. There's ups and downs to social media.
Yeah.
There's ups and downs to the Seagrass products. There's ups and downs to all the field work we do. Sometimes it's bad, sometimes it's good, sometimes we get really sick. I would say everything's good.
Nice. That's a nice approach.
Always be positive.
Sounds like you should really go for it, then.
Yeah. So you're keeping yourself busy with the PhD and Project Seagrass.
Yep.
And all the other projects.
Yeah, all the other things I do.
So what are your plans right now and in the near future?
Well, right now, my PhD is the looming project now. Yeah, I suppose I'm really, you know, working away with that, but I guess it's just. seeing how things go. I have lots of fingers in all different pies, I suppose, and there's lots of projects that are ongoing. The thing that I'm trying to concentrate on most at the moment is the PhD.
Yeah.
Because
you have 2 years?
I have 2 years left, and the first 2 years have been pretty good, pretty productive. Got some nice research done so far, but now with coronavirus, I don't know the future of my field work in the tropics. I don't know if that's kind of hanging in the balance. But,
you have to do the Baltic instead.
I wouldn't mind.
Yeah.
But I prefer the tropical seagrass meadows.
Who doesn't?
Yeah.
Who doesn't, yeah.
But also, I mean, for the research fisheries, question I have, the fisheries and stuff, I'm sure I could find people to interview in the Baltic that like fishing and seagrass, but the poverty side of it and the that kind of agenda is different.
Question,
Yeah, of course.
Makes sense.
So yeah, I was supposed to be going to Indonesia in a couple of months, but that's doesn't look like it's
going to happen
with the current circumstances.
Yeah,
but we'll see when when I can.
It is what it is.
Yeah. I mean, yes.
No, I had to do the best about it.
Yep. It's not the end of the world.
No, definitely not.
No, and I mean, like, it's from an ecological perspective, you know, climate change is a far bigger challenge that has taken a back seat at the moment.
And
biodiversity loss is a bigger challenge that's also unspoken about. You know, it's good in some ways that this is, I feel like that there's positives out of everything.
Mm.
And the way that this pandemic has affected us, it shows us, like, you know, this is how quickly we need to act for other things too. If you see the handling of this and think, shit, we're unprepared, then we also need to look at climate change and think, we're totally unprepared.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it's good in some ways that it's given us a kick up the ass to make changes.
Yeah,
hopefully.
All right. So you're a little bit here and there in social medias, on Project Seagrass,
children's books.
We can find you anywhere, but if our listeners thought that this Seagrass thing is something they want to learn more about, where should they go? Your PhD, how can you learn more about your work? Or
I think for Project Seagrass, it would be to search for Project Seagrass on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram.
We're
going to
link it.
Yeah.
.org, right?
Projectseagrass.org.
Yeah.
Seagrassspotter.org.
Mm-hmm.
There's also a new one called seagrass.org.uk.
Okay.
I think. And that's our seagrass restoration hub.
You can
go on there and you can buy a patch of seagrass, effectively.
Wow.
You can donate
money
to
that's great,
to store some seagrass carbon and all that sort of stuff. So we've got a trio of websites now, but Project Seagrass is the one where you can get to everything.
Yeah.
Projectseagrass.org is the go-to website. And for information about my PhD, probably on my on the Project Seagrass website too. I have a profile on there where people can learn about a bit more about me and my work.
Perfect.
Sounds great.
Yeah.
But I'm regularly on Twitter. I tweet mostly about seagrass, meadows, other things too. But sometimes other things, but mostly seagrass, meadows.
Yeah.
Every day I either retweet something or tweet about seagrass. So I try to, at least, yeah.
Nice.
Yeah. And as a take-home message for us and listeners, can you tell us one thing that everyone could do for the seagrass?
Tell another person why seagrass is important.
That's a good one.
Nice one.
Yeah.
You know, there's the law, or the seven people, I don't know. Yeah.
It's like the rule of the five handshakes.
Something like that, yeah. If you were to go tell somebody you meet in the street, but your friend, ideally, don't just go
harassing.
But the seagrass.
I do that. It doesn't always go. No. Just go and tell someone everything you've learned today by listening to this about seagrass.
Yeah.
And then tell them to do the same.
Yeah. Great one. So one last question, and this is a follow-up in all episodes when we have guests. What is it that you love the most about oceans?
Please don't tell the seagrass.
No, the raw power,
I think. Yeah.
Growing up on the south coast of Wales, it's the second largest tidal range in the world, and one of the most kind of really, really rough areas of the tidal areas, and it's just amazing to see how quickly the whole seascape and the whole landscape can change in a couple of, you know, minutes.
Wow.
You can sit there and watch the tide. Right, you can walk with the tide. It's that quick sometimes, and it's just like, the raw power of how it destroys things, but also builds things and creates things. That's my favorite thing.
Yeah,
yeah, it's impressive.
But also the seagrass.
But also the seagrass, of course.
Yeah. That's it's raw power.
Thank you so much for coming and
thank you so much
for inviting us to your place.
Thanks for wanting to come.
It's been a really nice talk, and we will link all the Project Seagrass and Seagrass Potter down below.
Yep. Så tack för att ni lyssnade på oss idag, och glöm inte att följa och sprida oss vidare, och skicka gärna förslag eller kom med feedback på hur vi kan förbättra oss, eller om det finns någon gäst vi kan bjuda in i framtiden och så vidare. Och så vill vi än en gång tacka Planet Indigo för våran fantastiska jingle som de har gjort hos oss. Superlyxigt och snyggt, och verkligen är vi supertaggade på.
Ja, det är så nice.
Det är skitcoolt. Vi lämnar, som Daria sa på engelska, såklart alla länkar och grejer i beskrivningen. Och så vill vi passa på att önska er en fortsatt trevlig sommar.
Och så hörs vi snart igen.
Det gör vi. Ha det bra så länge.
Hej då.
Hej då.